We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I mean, it's been a disappointing rookie season for Wiseman. You knew that he was likely to struggle to get up to speed in terms of how little high-level basketball he'd played and how little in the past year and a half. I think the fact that he's probably has perhaps not been as physically dominant as, say, DeAndre Ayton was a couple years ago is a little bit of a concern for me. You know, they're similarly effective around the rim, but Wiseman has more of a tendency, I think, to, you know, prefer the face-up jumper. The fact that he knocked down a couple threes in the season opener in Brooklyn maybe kind of worked to his detriment long-term in terms of convincing him that should be a big part of his game. But, you know, if you get outside the top 10 and you're putting him in that San Antonio development system for a team that does have Jakob Poeltl as a young option in the middle, but, you know, probably has more need for a front court player than they do on the wing with the number of guys there and on the perimeter, I think that at this point it's a reasonable gamble to take.
A gamble? James Wiseman is now a gamble at 12 to the Spurs.
He was a gamble at 2, though. Let's be honest.
He was, and he's had the kind of season that would make you wonder if this gamble may or may not still pay off. I'm betting on it, but obviously some people are starting to bet against it. And one of the most interesting people to talk basketball with is ready to go with us as we welcome everybody to their 3 o'clock hour.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game. KGMZ FM and HD1 in San Francisco. It's an Odyssey station.
Our friend Tim Bontemps from ESPN joins us once again talking NBA. Tim, as always, we appreciate your time, pal. How you doing?
Doing well, fellas. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you very much. We got the Warriors back in town for their final 6 of the year. Couple really winnable games with the Thunder right around the corner. It's too bad James Wiseman's not going to be out there. It's been a shame that he hasn't been able to participate in so much of this year, even when he was borderline healthy. It was in two games, out another. At least that's the way it felt. Kevin Pelton said if we redrafted, he'd be slipping outside the top 10. Are you that harsh on his rookie year?
Well, I think to be fair to my guy, Kevin Pelton, who is a very sharp guy, if you look at where James's rookie season has played out, I mean, I think that's probably about where he should be because it has been a rough year. To your point, he hasn't been healthy. When he has been out on the court, he's been pretty ineffective. But again, like I think Ray just said before, you know, the Warriors drafted a guy who had played 3 games in basically 2 years when they drafted him with the second pick overall in the draft, right? So I don't think anybody necessarily expected him to walk in and immediately be a dominant player right away. And there was going to be a learning curve. And I think the fact that he has had injuries and he was in and out of the COVID protocols and everything else that went on this season kind of stunted that development a little further. So, you know, if he can have a full off season to, you know, work on his game and kind of, and, you know, participate in whatever kind of summer league there is and come into the season next fall with, you know, his legs under him, I think he'll have a chance to take a big step forward. I mean, if you look at a guy like RJ Barrett, for example, you know, he was drafted 3rd overall. He didn't make either all-rookie team last year. And this year he's shooting 40% from 3 and looks like a guy who is going to be, at minimum, a really good, solid, you know, long-term investment for the Knicks. So this stuff changes really fast. And despite the fact that it's been an up-and-down rookie year for James, I certainly don't think anybody should be waving the white flag and thinking his career is over. And,
right.
And I think if you ask Kevin, I think you'd say the same thing.
Right. And I appreciate that your friend Kevin Pelton is good at what he does. And in any NBA draft, even a redraft, we're still interested in potential. Have you capped in any way in your mind the potential on James Wiseman to ever live up to that draft status now? I mean, I've seen 19-year-olds look lost who turn into Jermaine O'Neal.
Right. The issue I had with that pick, Damon, in the first place was that in today's NBA, and the Warriors have proven this more than anybody with Draymond at center, right? I didn't like investing the second pick in the draft on a center. And I would have taken LaMelo Ball with that pick at the time. I thought he was the best player in the draft. And I think if you have a pick that's that high in the draft, to me, or really at any point, if you're evaluating talent in today's NBA, you're going to take a wing or a guard over a big anytime that the talent is neutral or close in terms of value, right? So I would have preferred either of those guys. Frankly, at the time, I probably would have preferred Tyrese Haliburton to James Wiseman just for that same reason. But I think if you're looking at James's ceiling as a player, you know, he's a 7-footer who's really athletic, who is by all counts a really good kid who works hard and has got a good jump shot. So certainly we could be sitting here a couple of years from now and, you know, Kevin mentioned DeAndre Ayton in that answer. You know, DeAndre Ayton as a rookie didn't look so great, and a couple of years later he looks like a pretty darn good player. And I think if James Wiseman has a similar development path, the Golden State's going to be pretty darn happy with the outcome.
Rating him 12th, I mean, I get that. He did not have a kind of impactful year. But this was not supposed to be a great year for rookies. Were there 11 guys who actually had good years as rookies, or is this really more of a statement about how little Wiseman provided?
I would say it's a combination of the two, Ray. You know, my guys, Mike Schmitz, and the other guy on my podcast, they kind of went back and forth and picked their guys. And there's some guys I would have had Wiseman ahead of. I would have had him ahead of Isaac Okoro. I would have had him ahead of Denny Avdija. There are a couple of guys that I would have picked him over in the top 10. So maybe he would have been, I don't know, 7th or 8th instead of, or 6th instead of 11th. But, you know, ultimately, I think this is less about really what this season has been or even Wiseman's future, and more just that, like as you guys have said, this has been a disappointing year for him for a lot of reasons that are out of his control. You know, the offseason didn't help him as a guy who had no experience. He imagined how he would have looked if he had a typical summer league and a full offseason and a full training camp, right? That would have been a big thing for a guy like him. You know, but he didn't have any of that. And then during the season, the Warriors were trying to win games and trying to, you know, also develop him at the same time, which is an awkward thing to do. And then he had a bunch of injuries and was in and out of the lineup with COVID, and now has the meniscus injury. So I think more than anything, it's just been a disappointing season for him. But I don't think it is a death knell in his career. And I don't think he's, you know, greatly diminished as a having a chance to be a really good long-term player. I just think it was a rough rookie season, and he could easily bounce back and look a lot better in year two.
Tim Bontemps, ESPN, here on 95.7 The Game. So, at the beginning of the year, if I offered you the Lakers or the field, a lot of people would have jumped at the Lakers. I don't know who's taking the Lakers over the field right now in terms of winning an NBA title.
Yeah, I would have taken the field, and I still feel good about that. You know, no disrespect to the Lakers for winning the title. They deserve everything they got from being in the bubble, but if you go back and look at the way teams played there, the Lakers were one of the biggest beneficiaries of the fact that everybody shot the lights out in that environment in Orlando. You know, going into the playoffs and going into the bubble, that was a team, you know, the biggest question about that team was it going to be able to score and shoot at the level necessary to win? And Anthony Davis, I think, shot 41% from three. All their supporting cast players really shot the ball.
Yeah, well, Rondo caught fire.
Rajon Rondo shot the ball great, right? You go down the list, all these guys that were not good three-point shooters all shot great. And if you look at their team this year, they're in the bottom five in three-point percentage. And their offense, I just don't think, ultimately, is good enough. And that's before you have the obvious concerns about Anthony Davis, who, while he's back in the lineup now, hasn't looked quite the same player he typically is. And anytime you hear about a guy having Achilles soreness, you have to be concerned. And LeBron James is clearly so bothered by this high ankle sprain, and that could linger for weeks, even if he does come back and is able to play. So, you know, it's hard to bet against LeBron James. Everybody in the Bay has seen him at his best in the playoffs and knows how good he is capable of being. But I think when you look at the amount of contenders that are out there that are really good teams, and you look at the challenges the Lakers have in front of them, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to get through another four rounds and repeat.
So Are they, in your mind, a play-in team or a playoff team?
I think they're going to be a play-in team, right? Because without LeBron James, I know they did get that win over Denver the other night, but you know, when they have this back-to-back coming up, it's hard to see them beating, you know, the Clippers tonight or the Blazers tomorrow. And if they lose those two games, then they have lost the tiebreaker to Dallas, they'll have lost the tiebreaker to Portland, and they're going to be looking pretty squarely at being the seventh seed. You know, and look, they could very easily win the first game in that play-in, but you know, if the league could sign up for LeBron James versus Stephen Curry in the 7-8 game in the play-in tournament, you know, Evan Wash, the league's director of strategy, will probably be asking for a raise, because that will be exactly the kind of scenario the league, you know, never would have realistically dreamed of when they set this thing up. But to have a game like that for a playoff spot is going to have a bunch of eyeballs on it, and it's, you know, it's going to be more proof of what I think has been a wildly successful development for the league to have this playing tournament, and one that I don't think is going anywhere anytime soon.
But if the league were that clever, wouldn't they have figured out a way to make New Orleans a better team so that Zion would be playing as well?
Well, think about it this way. Let's say right now, with San Antonio in a bit of a free fall without Derek White having to play a billion games in the second half of this season because of COVID, you could look at a scenario where you have LeBron versus Steph in the play-in tournament, the first game, in the 7-8 game, and if the Pelicans beat the Grizzlies, you could have the loser of Steph or LeBron playing Zion for the 8th spot in the playoffs in a win-or-go-home game. That really could be the dream scenario for the league, and especially, you know, look, Ja Morant, I think, is one of the most exciting young players in the league. You throw him in there too, I mean, that's four, you know, really exciting players to have in this, you know, kind of made-for-TV event the league is going to have. I think it could lead to a couple really dramatic games, and, you know, all these games down the last couple weeks of the season are going to have real meaning, which, as you guys know, as longtime watchers of the league like me, you get to these last couple weeks of the regular season, and generally we're just all kind of waiting to fast forward to the playoffs.
Yeah.
Very little drama. There's not a lot of excitement. And now there's two or three games a night that have massive implications for whether you're in the play-in, whether you're in the playoff, even in the playoffs at all. I think it's been awesome for the league, and I think it's going to lead to a lot of super fun basketball here for these final 10 days and into the play-in tournament after that.
I agree with you. Tim Bontemps, ESPN. Look, I'm just going to say it, and then your quick reaction. It's like a Rorschach test. There's no right or wrong answer to this, and we got to go real quick. So just what is your gut feeling to me saying NBA champion Utah Jazz?
I think it's possible. I wouldn't say it's likely.
Strong, as always. Thank you so much, Tim Bontemps, man. Good to talk to you. And we will check in come playoff time. We know you're all over the East, and we love catching up. Thank you so much.
Always great to talk to you guys. Talk to you soon.
There he is. Tim Bontemps here on 95.7 The Game. It's their year, Ray. Jazz. Write it down.
I'd like to. And they might end up doing it because I don't think the rest of the West is as good as we have thought it was going to be. In large part because the Clippers, while good, are not dominant, and the Lakers are a shell of themselves. But I could easily see Utah having trouble with Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I don't think they'd have trouble with Brooklyn because Brooklyn doesn't defend. But I also think they might have some trouble if they were playing Milwaukee in the final.
Could be interesting. Could be interesting. I'm just floating it out there.
No, it's fine.
Floating it out there.
At least you didn't say Minnesota.
888-957-9570 is the number. We're coming on back. We got open lines for you. And we got an open mouth from Jed York talking on a podcast. What did Jed say? We'll find out next here on 95.7 The Game. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, and we're brought to you by Network Capital Funding.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Really good to have you along today. We've got Alex Dickerson joining us in about 12 minutes from right now. Giants left fielder. A fabulous conversation each and every week with the guy. We're going to talk to him about trip to Colorado. He always plays well against Colorado. Got great career splits against the team. Obviously, they had to split that doubleheader. That just hurt because they were in charge and control of both of those games until They let go of the rope at the end of Game 2 in that doubleheader day, and now the Giants come back to take on the San Diego Padres, and obviously Alex Dickerson knows an awful lot about them, and it's Willie Mays' birthday, so we got an awful lot to talk to Alex Dickerson about in just a little bit here. John Shea, a little bit later on today, he wrote the book 24 about Willie Mays. It is his 90th birthday. Not John Shea. It's Willie Mays' 90th birthday.
Yeah, Shea's 86.
Looks good. Wears it well. He really does.
Talk to him. You'll see where the 86 comes in.
There we go. I'm glad he's wearing down. John Shea, a little bit later on this afternoon, as we talk about truly one of the great baseball players of all time, where's the rubber meet the road on who he really was as a player. The myth from the facts, the front of the baseball card to the back of the baseball card, where is the truth on Willie Mays? We're going to get to all of that coming up in just a little bit. But as I said, Jed York spoke, Ray, which apparently is something that gets the entire Bay Area hot and bothered. It's because, let's just say, opening up his mouth in the past wasn't necessarily a good service for either him, the Niners, the coach that he might have been talking about, the quarterback he had been referencing, the game, the evening. There were not a lot of messages Jed was sending that were received well. So now whenever Jed attempts to send a message, should he even be messaging, is the very first hurdle we all clear before we even dive into, well, what did he actually say? We're going to get into what he actually said, but first of all, how do you feel about him just having the gall to speak about the team that he owns?
It's not that he spoke. It's that he spoke sort of inconsequentially, you know, just sort of, hi, I'm going to just like be playful about this. No, if you don't have anything like important to say,
those are the tweets.
People, it's still him saying it,
okay,
whether he's typing it or not, or more likely that he's having somebody else type it for him.
Oh no, he's got his own fingers on that Twitter. I don't think Jed says, tweet that for me, Joan and Payroll.
Oh, I think Joan and Payroll would be tweeting that, absolutely. But to me, he's better served just sort of letting Kyle Shanahan do the talking and not even daring to like sort of peep his head out. Because what happened when he tweeted those things the other day? We thought he was loony. How did he benefit from that?
Well, after the fact, he gets to say, hey, I had a little, you know, coded message for you. There was an answer to who we were going to draft in there. If you knew enough, if you had your little orphan Annie decoder ring, you could have figured it out.
You know what? That's what John Lynch gets to do. I don't think Jed York's a bad guy, but he's not a natural comedian.
I'll agree with you there.
And so, to me, those tweets just went, what are you drooling? I mean, did you just have a trip to the dentist and the drugs haven't worn off?
Here's the deal about Jed. Jed understood that his mouth was writing checks that he couldn't necessarily cash. So for years there, he did go underground. Less was more from Jed York, and it worked out for him. And he, I think, read the room, realized, little less of me, little more of them, and that's good. And he has stuck to that game plan. So for him to finally acquiesce to do one interview in a friendly atmosphere, it's the Matt Maiocco, Laura Britt, hey, how are you, Niner podcast over at NBC Sports Bay Area. So he's in friendly terms.
Yeah, I wasn't talking about the interview. I was talking about the tweets last week.
Okay.
The interview, you know, so they clearly asked him, will you speak? And okay.
He said, okay.
Now we'll see what he says.
Well, as you can imagine, the very first topic was, what are you going to do with the rookie and the incumbent, whose name is Gucci? And here's what Jed York had to say about Jimmy Garoppolo and the handoff of power and how this could be the problem that every team wished it had.
We've talked about this internally. You know, if we are in a situation where Jimmy goes out and takes us to the Super Bowl again and has an MVP caliber season and does it again, there are worse dilemmas to be in. And Jimmy certainly has the ability to do that. I think Kyle's talked about that all along, and knowing it's the most important position in sports. And it's great to have a guy that you do believe in, that has gotten you to a Super Bowl, so you don't have to put the weight of the world on a rookie, whoever it was that we were going to choose. Now that we know that Trey is here, you don't have to put the weight of the world on that kid's shoulders, and he can grow into that position.
I mean, nothing to get mad at there. Nothing controversial.
He adhered to the company line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. Good answer. And I tell you what, he's right. He's right. You know, Jimmy's got two things he needs to do. Everything's going to be fine. It's two things. Ball out. That's it. If he balls out, he's QB1 all year.
Yeah, I mean,
that's how it works.
And I'll be honest with you. I think the greater likelihood is that you can extend that to 2022 as well. Because if Garoppolo plays all 17, he's clearly playing to Shanahan's satisfaction.
Something
which means,
went very well.
Which means that there aren't a whole lot of reps for Lance. And the thing that has always resonated with me is when backup quarterbacks become starters, one of the things they talk about more than anything else is it's hard to get reps.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you're going to see what kind of improvements you're going to get in Trey Lance that you can bank on. So I think if he doesn't play very much this coming year, that means that 2022 becomes dodgy too, because I don't know where those reps are going to come from. I mean, until he's starting to get those, he's always going to be kind of behind the eight ball, given the fact that his own resume is sort of thin on experience, both in high school and college. It's a little bit of the James Weissman thing, which is you're banking on talent that hasn't really gotten a chance to flower yet. Even at North Dakota State, it's 1 year in a game.
No, it's he needs to do it. He needs the reps. There is no doubt finding the reps on the field on an actual game day. It's going to be really hard. It's even hard to find them on the practice field, was the point Ray's making, and he's right about that. You talk about 2022. I can see why that's the plan. Like, what a luxury that would be. Not a red shirt year, but a red shirt and a gray shirt. Like, we can go ahead and buy two understudy, just watch and learn years. Boy, that's a luxury that a lot of people should be more excited about than they are angry at it. And Jed York talked about that two-year time period being a reality.
You know, this Sunday, he turns 21. If he doesn't play until he's 23, you know, but he's got a 15-plus year career. I mean, you know, there were rumors about a guy, and obviously Kyle talked about trading for Aaron. How long did Aaron sit? 2-3 years before he played? And again, I want to make sure that we do everything that we can to make sure that that position is the best it can possibly be in the NFL. And even if he doesn't play for 2 years, we still have an extra $100 million to put back into our team on top of whatever we would have over free agency for the next 5 years.
Okay. He's right. He might not play for 2 years. If he doesn't play for 2 years, the first game you see him in, he's officially still an incredibly young guy. He's 22 years old 2 years from now. So it's not like he is going to, you know, you're not going to talk about those years that got away. You're not going to look at them as, man, wasted opportunity. There's going to be an awful long career you'd have in front of or behind him whenever he does start. The thing is, though, that two-year plan is a great plan. That two-year plan can become a two-play plan, especially when Jimmy Garoppolo is your quarterback. Trey Lance could be the 49ers' starting quarterback two plays into this year. And that's how you need to conduct business, because that's the reality. He is a snap away from being the starting quarterback. So you can talk about the two-year slow burn, slow play of Trey Lance's development all you want. But if you really are coming into next year and he is QB2, you're not putting him as QB3. You're not stashing him somewhere where he's still not playing, even if Jimmy goes down today because he ain't ready. That is how you could really screw things up, I think.
Well, no, if you insist on a plan in the National Football League, the only thing you're going to do is get God to laugh at you.
Right.
Every plan has a delete key. And circumstances will dictate that. But, and this is not even part of the plan either. you don't change a quarterback who's winning for you. And as long as Jimmy Garoppolo is winning for them, Trey Lance doesn't play. Because drafting him where they drafted him, or even wherever they would have drafted him, you know, he's still the backup. He's still judged to be the second best choice. And he only becomes the first best choice if Garoppolo fails miserably or if somebody injures him. I mean, the plan could be 3 years. I mean, Garoppolo could win for three years in a row. 49ers could be a 12-4 team all 3 years, do well in the playoffs, even if they don't win a Super Bowl.
Who's the first backup quarterback Jimmy goes down early in the year next year? Trey Lance or Josh Rosen?
Oh, it's Lance. There's nothing about Josh Rosen's resume that says that's the guy that this team's going to have confidence in. He's a placeholder. He's a glorified Josh Johnson.
Hey, it's good work if you can find it.
Sure, but, you know, it's not work that you will be satisfied with.
No, it's not rewarding.
You'll be getting a check so that you can hold an iPad.
Interesting stuff. Jed York would go on to talk about a little conversation he had with Aaron Rodgers. He would also talk about how Frank Gore is a ipso facto Trey Lance scout for the 49ers, and we'll get into that in just a little bit. But right now, we get to get into one of our favorite conversations of the entire week. Alex Dickerson of the San Francisco Giants, good enough to join us here on 95.7 The Game on Damon Ratto and Kolsky. No Kolsky this afternoon, this week. He's on paternity leave. Alex Dickerson, good to have you back, man. What's going on?
Nothing much. Just got back in. Kind of enjoying an off day.
Yeah, what are you going to do this off day? You do have a gorgeous day in San Francisco all to yourself. What's up?
Really just eating breakfast, enjoying some time with the family. It's about all you can do on these days.
There you go. What was for breakfast? Was it healthy, or did you go fat boy breakfast on us this afternoon?
Oh, Dev, I got a Belgian waffle at a diner that was just covered in whipped.
Nice. Very nice. It's a strong pair.
Covered.
Yeah. It's important to note that he did not mention these next 10 minutes as part of the fun day he's having.
That's okay, though. But he had that Belgian waffle, so it was a great start to the day. There's very little we can do to actually ruin it, I would hope. What a wild three-game series in Colorado, man. I bet it's a lot easier to like a seven-inning doubleheader game that you win than a seven-inning doubleheader game that you lose in the seventh inning.
Yeah, I mean, quite frankly, that's whether it's seven or nine innings, that's Colorado in a nutshell. No game is ever over there. It always ends up getting close at the end. And, you know, we ended up on the bad side of it, which is going to happen. But, you know, we're going to learn from that and bounce back.
I know that because you're in the middle of it every day, you don't sit there and take a daily temperature of sort of your team's place in the universe. But how much different is this team now after 32 games than it was, say, after 16? Do you get sort of a different vibe about strengths and weaknesses and things you can rely on and things that need improvement? Or do you even bother with that stuff?
You don't really bother with it. You're always trying to improve. Strengths and weaknesses are more, they're kind of relative. It's what people are saying, but it's not like we know that we're a team that's going to definitely hit better than we have to this point. And I think you're seeing flashes of it and it's starting to come around. And then we, for a fact, we have good pitching and defense now. And that's something that we're going to really kind of lean on through the times where our offense isn't going. And then, you know, as they kind of get fatigued throughout the year, we're going to hopefully pick them up on the other side of that. So it's really like kind of a daily, you do your, like, it's cliche, but you just try to do your best every day and improve on, you know, what you don't think you've been doing well.
There are little just signs of, hey, I know it's early, you know, saying first place San Francisco Giants is an awful lot of fun, but there's quite a bit of baseball in front of us. So what are the reasons to really be excited here? And
I think the reason to be excited, in my point of view, is that we know we haven't played our best baseball yet, and we are in probably, arguably, the toughest division in baseball, and we are right there.
Yeah.
And we know there's still room to grow, and I think that's really the exciting part of this, where we're at right now. Because you think about it, last year, I mean, it's a 60-game season, 30 games in, we were much worse than this, knowing that there was room to improve, and we almost got all the way back. This time around, we know we still haven't played our best baseball, but we've been in every single game, and we know we've got a shot to win all of them, and we haven't even really started hitting our stride with the offense yet. So I think that's kind of the exciting part for us, and knowing that it's 162 games with room for us to grow.
There have been stories and discussions over the last couple of weeks, sort of outside the clubhouse, about this being a particularly bad year offensively across baseball. Is that ever a conversation in the clubhouse? The notion that, you know, there are fewer hits, fewer runs, more strikeouts than there have been at any point since 1968. Does that ever come up? Do you guys ever just sort of chew the fat about that? Have you noticed that offense is worse?
You have the discussion about how good pitching has gotten over the years, and it just seems to, every time you think it can't get better, it seems like there's always some prospect shoots through, is sitting 98 with a disgusting slider. And I think all around we're starting to see kind of, and I think it's also showing up with injuries as well. We're seeing that the pitching body is starting to get maxed out, and you're seeing just insane velocity every day. And if your swing isn't in the right place, it's not like it used to be where, hey, you still manufacture a hit here or there. Like, if you're not in the right spot, you're probably going 0-for, and you got to try to find a way to be productive in other ways. And so I think that's kind of where we're at. And to be honest, like, we're still too early. 1 month in is not, that's not enough for me to say, like, oh, man, offense is done. I mean, yeah, it could be a league-wide slump to come out of this. It's kind of the way it is. We're getting used to traveling longer distances again, something we didn't do last year. And I think part of that might be wearing on some guys. And I don't know. I think it's too early for me to tell. But, yeah, I think the main discussion is velocity, just flat out, it's high. They're throwing hard now, every single guy. We're laughing at, used to be 90, 92 was, you know, pretty good stuff for a fastball. Now a lot of guys are throwing sliders at that speed. So that's just the reality of it. You got less time to react.
If 30 games is too few, when do you start feeling like, okay, this season has gone on long enough that I can make some assumptions about where the game is?
I generally say it's right around 65, 70. And like that's where you start to like make that evaluation of, okay, we're approaching halfway. Generally, you will see a lot of the guys that were hot the first month will go ice cold in the second one. Sometimes it takes till the third one, but it's going to happen. Same with the guys that are ice cold, that have a track record. They're generally going to get hot in May or June. It's at that point, you've now seen that turnover, and you start to see a little bit more balance. So, yeah, I would say around that 70, 75 mark, like kind of in between there is where you start to go, okay, here's probably where we're at and where it's going to head.
Alex Dickerson here on 95.7 The Game. So, again, the Giants have a number that I think is significant. That just, it's one that I lean into, and I'm wondering if there's a number or a stat that you can find in the standings that you lean on is more significant than others. Obviously, wins and losses count more than anything else. I'm a big run differential guy. And this is why the Giants have become the most interesting story in the first month of baseball, because you guys have the second-best run differential in the National League, all this pitching, and like you said, a lineup that hasn't even really come all the way around yet, but you still got the fifth most home runs, sixth most RBIs in the NL, third most walks. You guys are turning it and burning it up and down that lineup enough to where that run differential, like, that's a big number. Is that a big number to you?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, really, when you try to zoom out with analytics and you try to take the whole year, run differential is probably going to, it's probably going to tell you a pretty good story of how many games you were in. Now, there can be outliers in there. You can blow a team out by 25 or get blown out by 25. And that, in reality, that's one game. But I think over time, and, you know, as you zoom out and look at just being in every game, it's a big deal. Like, almost, I can't even really come off the top of my head where any ninth inning where it felt like, hey, we don't even have a shot here. Like almost every single one of them, it's been like, hey, we're one or two hits away from being all the way back in this thing. So I think that's something that the Dodgers have done over the past 5 or 6 years. They never really seem to be out of games. We're doing that very well right now, and I think the NL West, it's going to be tough. It's going to be a fight all year. And you know, I keep saying it over and over, but we know the offense has room to grow, and we know we're going to get there. So I think that's where our confidence kind of lies.
Yaz coming back, Cueto coming back, La Stella eventually going to return, more options, just more Giants coming soon, that's for sure. What's amazing is the Dodgers got off to such a great start, 13-2, and have lost 13 of 17 since. Obviously, the Padres got all this pitching and all this hitting, but putting it both together in the same game is something that's eluded them a little bit. And now here you are with the Padres, three games coming up, and then you got an eight-game road trip after, you know, you got the Rangers coming to town, then you go Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and these are basement dwellers. I know you got respect for everybody on your schedule, but how much do you start looking ahead? I you know, one game at a time is a wonderful cliche, but do you look ahead and start thinking, man, if we could put a good 2 weeks together right here, we're buying ourselves a little bit of a cushion.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that it is baseball, and I'm sure the Dodgers can correct me on this as well. Like, you can be as hot as you want, and then this game will always humble you. You don't look at any major league team as cupcake teams anymore. Like, at their worst, they still have three or four guys that can hit the ball out of the ballpark and about five to seven guys that throw high 90s, which if they're in the zone and locating, any day can be tough. So there's no – even when you're looking at bottom-dwelling teams, you really can't take it for granted going, oh, we got four in Pittsburgh. That's got to be four wins right there. You got to still go up. You got to show up, and you got to win them. So it really, like, it is cliche and it is boring as hell to say, but it is day by day.
It's true.
That's the only way that we can perform.
I know you didn't get a chance last year because of quarantine and COVID and everything, but have you had many dealings with Willie Mays from 2019? Did he get to come around the locker room?
Yeah, he was around quite a bit. I got to talk to him at length a couple times. And then I did get to feel that legendary handshake that at that time he was 88 years old, he still felt like he could just break your hand in half. And it's just incredible. And it's awesome how much passion he has for the game and being the legend that he is. He's just so humble. He comes in and just likes talking baseball. And it's, I'm hoping that if we get him back in the clubhouse sometime soon, COVID's obviously kept away. I know that's probably killing him. So. It'd be great to see him back in there. I think he just turned 90 today, right?
It is. Yeah. It's his 90th birthday. Is there a member of your family that would be most interested in meeting Willie Mays, which is probably, again, we get back to normal, you could probably arrange that. Who in your family would be most excited about meeting Willie Mays?
Yeah, I'm sure my dad would. He probably got to see a few of his games back in the day. And, I mean, there's very few legends that are as good as him, where he did kind of everything. So, yeah, I mean, several people in my family probably enjoy meeting him.
It's pretty cool.
When the first time you talked to him, how long did it take you to transition from, holy crap, I'm talking to Willie Mays, to, man, I'm going to pick his brain for a while?
I don't know. It came pretty quick. Murph, our clubhouse guy who's been there forever, he's the one that's like, hey, come meet somebody. And I walked in there, actually, to make it even crazier, I walked in there and this is my first time meeting Willie Mays, and right next to him was Barry Bonds. So I had two legends in one room at the same time, and got to talk a little bit of baseball, not a crazy amount, but I mean, any time you're around those guys, you just try to absorb anything they're talking about. It could be about eating breakfast for all you care. You just want to know how they do it.
So you're going to blame one of them for the Belgian waffle thing you do?
yeah, sure. I'll throw it on. Even though, no, we didn't get to that. Maybe next time.
So we have to play a little weekly version of Know Your Own Numbers and Stats. As you've been told, as we've discussed, You're a monster at Coors Field. You got a 420 career batting average at Coors Field. Second best stadium, though, of your career, Alex Dickerson, what stadium do you hit the hottest in?
Arizona. That'd have to be.
Incorrect.
Incorrect. Or, I mean, if you're going off one sample size, I'd say Toronto.
There it is. There it is. The Rogers Center in Toronto. Was it 13 at-bats. So, yes, it's officially a small sample size. But a 462 hitter with three home runs at Rogers Center, you need to get on your agent. You say, look, I love being a Giant, but you can get me to Coors Field or you get me to Rogers Center, and then I get to go to Cooperstown.
Yeah, one of those is in the fifth deck, too. So actually, funny story about that. Mark McGuire was my bench coach at the time, and I hit the ball in the ninth inning, hit it into the fifth deck. One of those where you hit it and the crowd kind of goes silent, and then when it hits, you just hear a ooh. And I came in, and Mark McGuire is the first guy I see, and I go, yeah, have you seen anybody do that? He's like, you just joined a very elite club. I was actually the first one to do it. And they found out we did it on the exact same day, 20 years apart.
Not bad. So who's been a fifth tanker at Old Sky Dome? You, Canseco obviously put one up there. McGuire one up there.
McGuire
is on the list.
Sean Green. I think out of lefties, I was the third to do it. I don't think Sean Green was the first. I know Juan Encarnacion has done it.
Did Cecil ever put one up there?
In recent.
Prince Oop. Fielder or Cecil Fielder ever put one up there, I wonder?
No. I don't believe they're on the list. Cecil Fielder's always, as far as tape measure shots, he shows up.
Yeah, his name.
Two stadiums.
Yeah.
Which has always been like my one dream that I still haven't quite done. I've gotten close. But I need to get one that literally goes out of the paying fans, and somebody that's not paying to be there gets a ball.
Or where you hit one off the face of the hotel.
Yeah, that would be great. It is like the one thing that nobody really gets to see, but every ballpark I go to, my one goal is to see how far I can get it into one of the decks. And like that's my batting practice. That's like my one fun thing I do every day. Is my last two rounds, I just try to see what places I can try to reach that day.
I mean, I remember
pretty good ones in batting practice.
I just remember trying to get it out of the infield, and I felt good about that when I could do that. Yeah, you're picking out sections of the stadium to hit it to. That's a nice little swing you got there, no doubt about it. Alex Dickerson here on 95.7 The Game. You brought it up. I know we've officially gone long here, but you brought it up, so I got to ask you. Mark McGuire. Give me a Mark McGuire story. Did you get to pick his brain about him and Sosa going back and forth? Is that something that maybe he doesn't like talking about because it didn't exactly end gloriously? How is Mark McGuire at peace at who he is?
Mark, he is so humble. He really doesn't get on those. Every once in a while he says something that we're... Like, he's super humble, but, like, you forget how, or you don't really forget, you know how good he is. And he talked about how he used to play pepper with the batter's eye when he was working on stuff. And you're thinking about, like, the batter's eye is 415 feet away, super high. Most people try to play pepper with the net that they're pitching behind. He's just kind of flipping it out there. But, with Mac, I think the Toronto story is probably my best one with him, but the one thing he talked about with his eyes and how he worked on, he could see pitching windows and physically see guys' hands and what position they were coming through, so he knew what a curveball was coming before it even actually physically left the hand. And I tried to do it that day off of Hendricks. And to my surprise, I actually did see the hand on the changeup, but then I'd never tracked the ball. I just saw the hand keep going.
Right. You're looking at the guy's hand, not the ball.
Him and Bonds, like, they were just so elite. They do some things that were just crazy that I don't think you could teach.
What are you looking at? Fingertips, thumbs? What are you looking for on the hand?
Yeah, fingers, thumbs. You're looking for the position it's in. It's kind of hard to explain over the radio, but, like, yeah, you'll literally see, like, a C. Look for a curveball, you'll see a reverse C on a changeup, and then for four seam, you'll just generally see the ball And he was just elite and could pick that up and track the ball at the same time. For me, it's one or the other. So I tend to just keep my eyes soft focused and look for spin about 10 feet out of the hand.
Well, I'll tell you, I hope you get to pick up all the spin the Padres throw at you over the next three. Then the Rangers come to town. Then you're out on the road. We really appreciate your time as always. Enjoy the rest of your off day and have yourself a really good homestand. Thank you so much, Alex Dickerson. It's a pleasure, man.
Will do. Thanks for having me.
Always great. Alex Dickerson, man, that's one of the best interviews we've ever done with a guy. Every single time it gets better and better. He goes into, oh, let me give you this story. Let me give you that story.
Well, I mean, we went long, so he filled the time.
It's a secret.
That's why he makes the big money. That's why he's going to be filling in when I go on vacation.
I'm going to tell you right now, if that guy wants to be a broadcaster when it's all said and done, that's going to be out there for him if he really wants to. That is somebody who's just comfortable talking. Period and end of story.
Kolsky has to be careful. There's an empty seat in this room.
That's right. That's right. We're talking about Warrior roster spots available. You got to fill them. You don't want to waste empty roster seats. Just saying. Better get back.
I think within 10 days, not just because that's when he's coming back, but the sleeplessness will get to him, and he will need to come here. Even as horrifying a possibility as that is, he'll need to get back for his own sanity. Because otherwise, it's zombie heights.
Yeah, it's coming. It's officially coming. And then it's gonna come for me eventually. Happens again. Oh, good times.
Was Jack a good sleeper?
He's an awesome sleeper.
Then you know what that means?
The next one is hell.
Little Xerxes,
yeah.
You'll be driving him around her around for hours.
Xerxes.
You'll be putting her in the baby seat on top of the dryer. Anything to simulate movement so that they won't be screaming in your ear. Trust me, you don't get two in a row. It's the rule of thumb.
No, we've been told. And this one, it's really, he's good-natured, he's smiley, he's charming. That means the next one's going to be the devil.
Yeah. Or he'll develop it eventually. But you're not getting out of this one alive.
It's good times. Good times. Again, thanks to Alex Dickerson. Another phenomenal interview with him. What a great, great, great weekly conversation we got going on with the guy. And he's right. You got to stay humble in this game of baseball. The series against the team that isn't playing well is... Well, I mean, that's what the Dodgers just walked into when they went and meet the Cubs, and they got swept. So, you know, it is a funny sport, man. It's a funny sport. Hot one day, cold the next. A's, by the way, got clobbered by Toronto when it's all said and done this afternoon. So the Blue Jays win on getaway day. It's going to be a 2-2 series split. Mike Fiers, not exactly starting his year where they hoped. He was held back due to that hip problem. He's come in a couple games now. I didn't see what his line was today, but I know that they were down early, and he was today's starting pitcher, so that can't be good news for Mike Fiers' afternoon.
Well, let me look at that, because I'm here to help.
Thank you very, very much.
3.1, 3 1/3 innings, 9 hits, 5 earned, 2 strikeouts.
Not the best day.
No, he got kicked around a bit.
Not the best day. Albert Pujols. File this under not the best day. Albert Pujols was DFA'd by the Angels. What an unceremonious ending it is to a Hall of Fame career. The Angels paid twice the price for a player that wasn't half the guy he was when he was in St. Louis, but was still very good for a long time, but not good enough to ever get the Angels into the postseason. And look, it was supposed to be Trout, Pujols, Ohtani. Like, that's supposed to be like a little murderer's row. 1-2-3 right there. Never really came together. Not the way that they envisioned, not the way that they had hoped.
Ohtani was hurt last year. Last year was a throwaway, but Ohtani was hurt. And really, before that, you know, Pujols stopped being a force in 17, which is before Ohtani got there. So If people in the Angels organization were still expecting Albert Pujols to be a mega productive hitter in his 39, 40, and 41 years, well, then they're probably not equipped to run a baseball team. I mean, because the signs are already there that Pujols had run his race. And I don't hold the other years when the Angels didn't do anything against him, because he was in the 6 years when he was really good, he was standing out there largely by himself. That team didn't pitch very well. And that's the thing. It's just that unlike any other sport, there isn't one hitter unless he's an extraordinary player who can take an entire team sort of day in and day out and say, follow me. That's why Bonds at his height was so remarkable, because he was a guy who actually made pitchers physically afraid. And Albert Pujols, as good as he was, couldn't do that day in and day out. I mean, it's an almost impossible thing.
Yeah, no, look, Pujols was an unbelievably special player, but in terms of how much trouble are you in if you throw a strike to him, that's where Barry Bonds, I think, leads the conversation in the history of Major League Baseball. Barry would get four good pitches a week. Two of them would go in the bay. I mean, he got nothing in years where he hit 73 home runs.
Well, but the more compelling stat that you just said is he got four pitches to see in a week. I mean, that's normally an at-bat.
Yeah.
I mean, minimum two. I mean, the year that the most compelling stat, I think, of all the ones ever was the year he walked 232 times, including 120 times intentionally.
120 intentional walks.
I mean, literally, that's one-fifth of your season where pitchers said no. I mean, he got walked, I think, to force in a run by Buck Showalter one time.
Yeah, and the Diamondbacks won
that
game.
And they won the game.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I mean, there was absolutely no reason ever to pitch to him. He should have walked 400 times.
We're going to come back with more of this in just a minute. 888-957-9570. We're also going to talk to John Shea next hour because it's Willie Mays' birthday. He wrote a big book about Willie Mays, so that's why John Shea's stopping on by. Plus, we'll talk a little actual baseball with him. So stay with us here. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, and we're brought to you by Fremont Bank. Full-service banking, no compromises.
Tomorrow.